just to be sure, I am Laura Weber, and I am the music director of your wonderful Livermore Amador Symphony, and we are so excited to be here tonight for a program of some of the most beloved works of the Romantic era in symphonic classical music, hence the title, Romantic Masterpieces. We open with two works of Tchaikovsky that I hadn't realized until I read Kathy's program notes that they were written in the same year. Of course, Eugene Onegin and Violin Concerto and several other very significant and important works of Tchaikovsky's were composed in 1878. And this was a really challenging time for Tchaikovsky. He was in a loveless marriage that had been broken up. He was hiding his identity and nature for fear of being persecuted as a gay man, and really struggled with melancholy, Tchaikovsky did. One of the qualities of romantic music is that the music itself deeply reflects very clear emotion and deeply felt, sometimes existential qualities to music and phrasing. And no one wore their heart on their sleeve more boldly and beautifully than Tchaikovsky. The Polonaise is our first work, and I keep saying it's like popping the cork on the bottle of champagne for the concert. It's short and sweet and fun, and it's also one of those pieces that's sort of like, hey, the concert is starting! Get ready! And then on we go with the Violin Concerto. I find it really interesting the two pieces were composed in such proximity. There's kind of a similar motive that they each share. The Polonaise, the accompaniment rhythm is yum ba ba bum bum ba yum ba ba bum bum da yum ba 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 da yum ba ba bum bum bum, and it's in three beats. And the big main theme of the first movement of the Tchaikovsky, ta ta ti da da di da. In four, ya ta 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 ya ta 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 ta. So we have ya ta 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 ya ta 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 for the opening and working. Ya ta 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 just add a beat. So it was meant to be, and the Franck really is one of the most significant romantic symphonies of the period. It was the only symphony César Franck wrote, and it opens with a question of the deepest, most personal, undefined nature. We don't know what his question was, but it's clearly posed in the opening of the symphony, and the entire remainder of the symphony is its answer in various forms, often very dark and heavy and weighted, and at other times more jubilant and celebratory. And the heart of that symphony that I think holds the keys to the universe is the second movement, which begins with the strumming almost of a lute effect created by the strings and harp to introduce a beautiful song in the second movement that is sung out by the English horn and answered by a counter melody and other instruments. It's simply one of the most remarkable symphonies of the period, and it's a privilege for us to bring it to you. And it was the very first symphony that I ever conducted with the Livermore Amador Symphony. But our really great joy this week has been welcoming Elizabeth Pitcairn, the wonderful American virtuoso violinist who I find to be one of the most complete musicians that I've ever known. She and I go way back. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But Elizabeth isn't just a phenomenal violinist. She is inside this music in her whole being. And every ounce of her is telling the composer's story and giving her all to every note and every phrase. And this is rare. And I find it incredible that this is now the second time she will have been to Livermore to perform with us. And she's a dear friend. Please join me in welcoming Elizabeth Pitcairn. Come on down. Welcome. Livermore this trip?
Very much. Gotten to see some of the beautiful countryside and experience culinary delights.
It's true. It's true. We go way back. Back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, we were students at the University of Southern California. I'm the older one. I was a graduate student. And you were an undergraduate student. And we sort of grew up together for a few years at USC at a time when some pretty extraordinary other students were there who we revere and remain in contact with. And we were taught by the same teacher of the orchestral program, Mr. Daniel Lewis, who I still can't call him Daniel. I have to call him Mr. Lewis. So we shared kind of a heritage together. And I have to say, 10 years ago when you came, I don't know if I ever told you this, I was actually really nervous to perform with you because I know you know. I know she knows, I know you know, that we have this standard that's ingrained in us and this sort of heritage that's been handed to us. And thankfully we got over that. I got over that really
well. Well, we were doing a piece together 10 years ago that we had not done in the time we were students, and unlike this time.
Unlike this time. And how many years ago was it we did Tchaikovsky?
I think it was like 29 or 30.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was our first, right?
Yeah.
Then, not now, thankfully. We have a few more of those for about,
so just the same.
In a way, although I don't know about you, I feel a little bit older. But it is such a joy. I was just explaining the way that you engage musically is so complete. You engage the music from the inside out. It's not just great violin playing, and it's not just great violin playing on a legendary instrument. It is, listening to you practice has been revelatory. You embody everything that I realize we try to do in our rehearsals. And I just wonder how you came to that type of preparation and how, when you're preparing a work like this, where do you start?
Usually with the first note.
Right.
And then I practice the end extra hard.
Right. And something happens in the middle.
Yeah. But that they don't remember.
Right.
When I was little, I used to fall asleep at night listening to my mother practicing the cello in the living room after she put us to bed. She'd go and do her practicing. And so growing up in a very musical household, my dad was an amateur opera singer, so there was always musicians in the home and concerts being presented. I was fortunate to go to the University of Southern California and study with Robert Lipset, who taught me great practice skills and confidence on stage and practice performance. Probably around when I was about 30, something really clicked. That's when you kind of meld between being a very good student and the maturity of knowing who you are and what you have to say. Mm-hmm. And then it started, like what you said, Laura, about sometimes you feel like you leave yourself on stage, and when that happens, you're not even really present anymore, but you're some kind of conduit channel for the music. And I think the audience can feel when you're gone, well, that's when the magic happens.
That's a really interesting way of putting it. I do find that to be true. I mean, we're always thinking in present about what's happening, but you do. There's a focus achieved that your own self-consciousness means. That's what feels like connection. Yeah. And it just feels, for me to work with a soloist like Elizabeth, what's so amazing is that your musicality is so innate and so strong that I feel like my ear simply attaches to you. And so I have no fear. Like, there's no uncertainty. There's no, is she going to do a thing here? It's so clear that it's sort of like you are operating my hand as well as yours. And I think your point, don't we all feel that way a little bit as professionals in the world when you know you've kind of found your footing? It's because you have matured in some way. Yeah.
It's a two-way street, and
notice about, especially in the first movement, is how often you are playing more than one note. There are so many chords, either, you know, sort of an arpeggiated chord or just a simultaneous double stop where you're playing thirds. Is that, am I correct that there's just a lot more of that in this concerto than in many others?
I would say so. This concerto, well, it has an amazing cadenza in the middle that Tchaikovsky wrote himself, which was really rare. Mendelssohn wrote the first cadenza. Mozart left the cadenzas to the instrumentalists to create something of their own. But these later romantic composers wrote out the cadenzas, so did Brahms. So there's a lot going on in there, for sure.
Oh, yes, and another reason, I'm sure, why the slow practice, because there's so many notes that are being balanced in tunes, which is something we do too, but it's very interesting when it's all happening in one player's left hand. And there's a lot of beautiful things that the instrument does in this concerto, where the melody is entirely played by harmonics, or as we were discussing earlier, the opening theme of the second movement is played muted by the soloist. And the opening of the third movement, that's really interesting. So we play this huge ramp up of energy with the motive of the rondo theme, and you start, it's on an A, right? You start on an A, and you're stuck down there on an A for the longest time. And the violin tries to come out of the A, but it's almost, I mean, do you feel like you're being held captive on a dominant note there when you start?
That part is, it just reminds me of like the Cossack dance in Nutcracker.
Oh!
With the whole thing of the third movement.
I hadn't thought of that. You're right. Absolutely.
And even when he was, you know, when Tchaikovsky does that thematic in legato in the lyrical section, it's always fun, fun, song, or fun, fun.
Yes.
In some form.
Beatbox the whole concerto. Yes, it's a unique concerto for sure. And I guess currently my favorite. It's hands down one of the great concertos ever written. Never ever get tired of playing it, and actually recorded it when I was 24. I left a lasting impression. Yes, indeed. That was so. And you've recorded all the major concertos with many of the great orchestras of, as we were also speaking the other day, of the former Austro-Hungarian empire. Thank you, I just fully lost the word empire. Thank you. What is it like for you to play these standard works with so many different orchestras? I mean, it must be, I know what it's like to work with different orchestras and how different responses are, and every orchestra kind of has its own character. What is that like for you as a soloist?
Well, the most important part is the conductor.
Right, right.
You feel like you're touching the past, and you know the present when you get to go, because you grow up and you see the names of these composers, Beethoven and Schubert and Mozart and Brahms, and then when you passing through Vienna and you say, oh, maybe I could go and visit their graves, and these were real people, they were magicians. I mean, when you don't think that they could be real when you're small, and you're like, how could anyone do that? And then when you go to, like, I've played a lot in Poland, over 20 different cities now, in Hungary, in Serbia, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Croatia, the whole borders, Ukraine, and not to mention many other countries, but it's, you connect with the people, and for me, I'm always connecting with things that, like, Wieniawski, the Polish composer, was someone that I really love to play, so I went to visit his grave, walked out of Warsaw, and actually took out my violin and played in the forest.
Oh my goodness. Did you take out this violin?
Yeah, I did.
It was shady. So I'm thinking about Wieniawski and the history of your instrument, and would they have had any contact?
Yes. Possible. it seems like it was a long time ago, but it's really just a couple hundred years that we're talking about. My instrument was made in 1720, and I've been to Cremona, Italy, the birthplace of the Stradivarius. And so that's, and then there's the Piazza Stradivarius statue of him handing his toast to the young boy.
Right. So, and yet, even though we're walking through history with this music, increasingly, as I live my life, I feel like I am closer to those stories in my life or in our life as a civilization. I mean, unfortunately, some of the things we've been experiencing in recent years, I can relate to all of the trauma that these composers have lived through, and all of the history, and all of the progress, and all of the struggle. And someone like Tchaikovsky really expressed himself quite fully that way.
Well, I want to add something, if I could, about my summer program.
Yes, please. Oh, I didn't introduce that after you showed up.
It's really nothing. It's just, what's really heartening is that, you know, it's the last 100 years, these great soloists have been playing these works, right, by Tchaikovsky and recording them. And so you wonder, youth today, are they still going to be interested in playing these same works? And I run this summer camp for children in the Adirondacks, and what's heartening is that more and more kids are coming, and they all want to play these pieces, and they're from 8 years old to 18, and they're totally immersed the same way we were. No change.
It's still there. Yeah, and the music camp that Elizabeth runs is the Luzerne Music Festival and camp up in the Adirondacks in New York State, and a camp that you went to as a young formative musician, and what you're doing to bring the next and the next and the next generation of musical humans to our stages is, you know, in addition to your work as a soloist, is so marvelous.